Good morning and welcome to Listen Local, the bi-weekly webcast from your neighborhood news source, Mission Local. The number of eviction notices issued in San Francisco has dropped from its peak, but evictions take their toll long after the notice is sent. When artist and writer Paul Madonna was evicted from the Mission District, he used his art to explore that experience. His series in the San Francisco Chronicle, All Over Coffee, ended after the eviction, and the pieces from that time were turned into a book. That book is called On to the Next Dream, and Paul Madonna joins me today to give us a taste of what's in it. Paul, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Laura, for being here.
My pleasure.
So nothing I say is really going to give people a sense of what you've created here. So let's have an excerpt. I was hoping you could read a chapter for us. I think we were hoping for chapter zero.
Chapter zero, which is sort of ground zero of the book. It's actually a chapter that I wrote maybe about three or four chapters in when I realized I needed something to contextualize the book for people.
Okay.
As a way to bring them in the moment, sort of literally put them in a seat, put them in the experience. And I think it's exceptionally relevant given the current news in the past couple of days. I think that as soon as I read this very short chapter, anyone listening will understand unless they've been hiding in a cave. Okay, this is chapter zero of On to the Next Dream. Imagine you're on an airplane. It's a long flight, international, crossing an ocean. It can be to anywhere. You decide. Pick someplace good, a place you love or have always dreamed of seeing. You've already boarded, stowed your luggage, fastened your seatbelt, and suffered the safety video. The plane has taken off and the cabin lights have dimmed. Maybe you've read a few pages of a novel, or maybe you've dialed up a movie, but either way, you've settled in and fallen asleep. Now everything is shaking. You open your eyes to see a stewardess with her hand on your shoulder. Excuse me, she is saying. Her eyes are intense and hard. Is there a problem, you ask? Groggy, confused, you lurch forward and look around. Rows of your fellow passengers are sitting peacefully, most with blankets tucked up to their chins. In the aisle, there appears to be an especially long line for the restrooms, but that doesn't seem worthy of concern. I said, excuse me, the stewardess says again. And this time she grabs a fistful of your shirt. You need to get up. What, you ask? Why? But she has already unbuckled your seatbelt and is pulling you to your feet. She is remarkably strong. You need to go, the stewardess says. And as she tugs you into the aisle, a new passenger slides into your seat. Without a word, this person kicks off their shoes, reaches into the seatback compartment, takes out the book you had started reading, and settles in. This makes you angry, but when you turn to give the stewardess a piece of your mind, she shoves you hard and you go stumbling down the aisle. You try to regroup, but she keeps shoving you until you're at the front of the plane where another stewardess is turning the handle to the door. You want to scream, wait, but then the door opens and a blast of cold air rushes in. Shockingly, you find you can still breathe, and even more shockingly, no one else on the plane seems to care. The guy sitting right there in the emergency exit row, he just pulls his blanket a little tighter and slides the courtesy sleeping mask over his eyes. Please, the stewardess says, don't make this any harder than it needs to be. And she motions to the open door. Outside, you can see only blackness, maybe some white-gray clouds far below, but otherwise, nothing. The stewardess, frustrated by your unwillingness to move, rolls her eyes, as if every second of your continued unwanted presence is an egregious and personally offensive violation of not just man's law, but God's as well. Seeing that you're one of those entitled types who won't go without a reason, though, she takes a deep breath and says, "The market has changed. We can now charge five times what you're paying for your seat, which means you have to get out." "But it's mid-flight," you say, "and I've already paid for my ticket." "You were only renting," she says, "and we own. This is just the way things are." And she pushes you out the door.
So when I read that, was that a United flight?
It is now. I think we didn't know until this moment. You know, the logo was sort of distorted in the experience, but now it's been made clear.
It has become clear.
Yes.
It's come through the clouds. But when I read that, my first thought was, oh my God, this is going to be one long, angry, anti-capitalist rant.
Interesting.
And I don't think it is. Do you think it is?
No, absolutely not. I had never felt that way about it either. That wasn't my emotional compass.
Mm-hmm. And then I read the rest of the book and I laughed a lot and I discovered that I was totally wrong and that's not it at all. but what struck me the most about that chapter is the detail where you say that you're shocked to find I don't know if I should refer to this character as you or book you.
You know, I've been saying, yeah, it's the fictional character of me.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So the fictional character of you is shocked to find that he can still breathe. And right. Everybody else doesn't seem to see a problem with this situation. Right. So for me, that was interesting because, of course, you know, there's the element of the callous neighbors who just don't care, or, you know, other residents who are unaffected by eviction who don't care. It's not their problem. But also that you can still breathe means this wasn't, you know, you weren't at death's door. This wasn't a threat to your life.
Right.
Why this metaphor then? Why jumping out of a plane? Tell me about this idea of being pushed out because you don't own.
Well, I think I talked about the emotional compass, or I would say absurdity is the adjective that I was using to write to. And the most absurd seat that you could lose is on an airplane because you're suspended above the air. There's a ridiculousness to it of leaving the plane in mid-flight. And I think that's a good point, that you can still breathe, because it shows that this is an unreal situation. And not just in the sense of course, we'd never be thrown off, but it's a fantastical book. So when we see that moment, we say, oh, okay, he's clearly bringing us to a place that isn't reality. Up until that point, you can say, okay, well, maybe this is just some weird draconian story. But if this is happening, if the door is open and all the passengers aren't acknowledging it, then I must be entering a world that is unreal. And that's very much where I want to take people. You know, every chapter begins with a very normal circumstance. Oh, you're going to look for an apartment. Oh, you're going to the renters union, going to do all these things. But then it very quickly accelerates into the world of the absurd.
Yeah. And to me, that was also interesting because the whole book ultimately seems to be about that your life is not over because of this eviction.
Exactly.
You went on to the next dream. And, you know, this is the beginning. This is a shock. This is terrifying. But you got through it.
Right. And I think that metaphor of being able to breathe still, it actually really does echo all the way through to the end. Because in the end, my life, or the fictional character of me, which eventually becomes what I hope the reader sees, is the every person. It's supposed to be everyone. And the idea of eviction isn't even about eviction anymore, but it's about loss. It's about change. And you've read the book, so you know that at a certain point, that me character starts to dissolve and becomes a reflection of the community and how people in general deal with their relationship to San Francisco or the place they live or anything that they ascribe value to. And that is ultimately where I want to take people because, again, right, it's not an angry book. It's not a book about passing judgment. And it's a very difficult, if we want to talk about eviction, it's a very difficult conversation because I'm on both sides of the fence. Like, I believe that owners who own a building have a legitimate right. If somebody buys a building and they want to move into their space, they can do that. There are laws in place that allow them to do that. And if they have good intention, then there's systems that hopefully can take care of everybody on both sides. But there's lots of abuse. And then there's lots of loopholes. And so it's not a clear cut, oh, this is wrong, progress is wrong. But we can't just let everybody run rampant with what they want either.
And you just mentioned that it's not about, you know, judgment. And
right.
I very much felt that when I was reading it. But also what made me love it is that the satire is just so delicious.
Oh,
and,
good.
And nobody gets away without a little bit of being poked fun at, right?
Including myself,
of
my
course,
own personal
yeah.
character. Yeah, yeah. I'm not without scrutiny.
Absolutely not. And what I saw a lot was that all these people who are, like you said, coping with San Francisco changing, or somebody who's reading coping with San Francisco changing, gets a little bit of, you know, it makes you feel okay about the fact that you're not always happy with this place. There's a segment where you talk about all the stuff that's awful. Like, you step in dog shit, and then, right. like, you run into somebody, and then somebody nearly runs you over and tells you that you're threatening his life, a cyclist, I think.
Yeah, which has happened in the mission many times, yeah.
That exact passage, I was thinking, oh my god, this probably happens to someone every weekend, this yeah. exact sequence of events. And it is absurd, and it still happens. What struck me is, like I said, that nobody gets away without a little bit of scrutiny here. Right. And I wonder if you can recall for us a little about how you move through this process, because it seems like you know what came out of it was funny, but it you must not have been feeling particularly humorous at the time.
I wasn't. And, you know, retrospect is, it's always dangerous to talk about one's emotional state in retrospect, because it's True. Easy to say, now that I've sort of landed and my life is resettled, I can talk about how, oh, I didn't want to be a victim, and I wanted to make, you know, turn negativity into positivity. And while there's truth in that, that's different than the immediate experience of the changes of the rug being pulled out from underneath your feet. But I can say that one of my guiding principles was to take my emotional experience and to process it into something creative. And I think in a way that became a sort of therapy. I think it's what we're all taught to do, how to mature and how to deal with our emotions so that we don't just react to everything. And my method of doing that was to write stories. And the way that I was able to process those emotions was to say, how do I want the audience to feel? What do I want to communicate with them? And the best metaphor I can create there is to, I thought, you know, if somebody goes up to a rooftop and starts tearing off their clothes and is screaming about how terrible the world is, everybody down below looks up and says, what's wrong with that person? And they don't necessarily think to help. Their first thought is, that person's crazy, watch out. As opposed to, oh, what is going on? It is provoking that person to behave that way. Because that's a complicated series of processes that we are often too, you know, ingrained in our own daily lives to take that time. And so I wanted to not run up to stop and scream, but to make something that...
You never did once?
Well, no, I mean, not, you know, figuratively, yes, or maybe in private I did, right? You know, of course, we let our emotions out in various ways, but in terms of the broader world, I wanted to make something that then we could have a conversation about that stirred those emotions in you. I didn't necessarily want to provoke somebody to run up and scream on the rooftop, but if it provoked those same emotions that might make them, then they would be forced to process that and say, why am I feeling this way? And I think that is sort of the higher role of the creator, is to not just express themselves, but to share what they were feeling in a way that creates that emotion within a reader. You know, there's a lot of, I think empathy is thrown around a lot right now. So, but that is sort of the creator's job, is to create an empathetic response.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say we're probably completely different people with completely different backgrounds, but I felt like you weren't expressing just what you were going through, but you're expressing what I feel in better words.
Well, thank you, because that means that I succeeded. Because really, if I run up to you and I'm angry and I'm just yelling and I start babbling about how screwed up everything is and how, you know, how hateful I think the world is, your first instinct probably isn't compassion.
No, it's to pull back. Defense. People feel threatened.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so that, again, is, you know, I really relied on that sort of intellectual goal of what is my job as a creative person. And that allowed me to deal with my emotional state. And in turn allowed me to ground myself and make my way through what was a very challenging and long situation. You know, this is something too, that's, I think when something happens in a moment, if you're in an accident, it's immediate and then the danger is over and then you're recovering. But something like this goes on for months and months and months. It's very difficult to get up each morning, to go to sleep at night, sleep comfortably, and you wake up and you have about a millisecond of like, oh, peaceful life. And then the reality of, oh, this is what's going on, floods over you, and just anxiety seizes every nerve in your body. You know, and that takes a toll very quickly.
Yeah, and I want to dig into that a little bit more, especially if you could explain to somebody who hasn't been through it why that is. Because I think people who haven't necessarily been evicted or for whom it wasn't such a big blow because they have the ability to go move somewhere else, don't really see that. I think for them it's very difficult to feel why you would be terrified when you wake up in the morning, right, if you aren't being evicted like that day or whatever it is. I think the book does a good job of getting into that, which is why I think people who talk about development and housing should read it. But you know, why is that so scary?
Well, it's because your foundation of your pyramid, right? If we think about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that foundation is being taken away. And when you have that foundation, you build on it and you no longer think about it. I call it the elbow effect, which is we don't think about our elbow until we jam it against the door and it's hurting very badly, you know, because it functions properly, which allows us to go on and think higher thoughts and to do higher things. And, you know, same with our health. When our health is bad, we're unable to focus on our bigger picture goals. Housing is the same way. And, you know, there's a lot of talk right now about healthcare and, you know, it being a human right, in which I absolutely believe in. And, you know, America being a very for-profit entity, you know, we're struggling with that as a people, as a community. But why that's difficult is because, and there's another aspect, which is shame. I think that's in San Francisco, in places like Manhattan or even Los Angeles and London, we understand that eviction is a product of a cultural shift. But outside of these communities, outside of our large cities, it's seen as something different. I think people don't get evicted in the same way in the suburbs. If you get evicted in the suburbs, it's probably because you've seriously defaulted on your life, be it forces out of your control or negligence, right? And so there's a shame that comes with that. It must be your fault, is the underlying thought. And so there's a lot of that to combat as well. And people who don't necessarily go through this, like, you don't have to be somebody who is lacking means or has done anything wrong to be evicted in San Francisco. And that's, I think, the most challenging point to get across, is that it's a bit like catching the flu. You know, it's like you just happened to be out somewhere and like then you came home and suddenly you have this sickness.
Or being the victim of a crime. I mean, I was just thinking when you talk about shame and this feeling that maybe we have some sort of responsibility or we could have done something, you know, in survivor's guilt, if you get robbed, whatever, you know, people feel that.
Yes.
And sometimes outside forces reinforce that.
Right. Or, oh, why were you walking down that alley at that hour?
Why are you renting in San Francisco and you haven't been thinking about buying a house?
Exactly. And so that brings us to another point, which is that for 10 years, I had been making a living as a writer and an artist and feeling successful. You know, I wasn't, a major celebrity, but I was certainly doing fine. And I was able to continue practicing my craft and build on it. And so I felt that I was a success and that I could continue building my career and my life. And when this came along and I wasn't able to turn around and just buy a $1 million home, I had to re-examine my definition of success, because I thought, well, if I can't find a place for myself to live, then how successful was I? And so literally in a moment, my entire perspective on my life, my goals and my achievements changed. And that is a symptom of not so much the eviction, but the economy, because it's a rare place that has such a large differential between your income and the amount that you have to pay in order to afford a home.
And I think a lot of people in the creative industries, for lack of a better term, journalism included, feel that way a lot, because you have to ask yourself, well, I'm never going to make more than X amount, or I'm never going to make enough to conceivably buy a house, or whatever metric of success you might have set up for yourself at the beginning. Does it even count?
Does it count
as success? Does it count am I doing a good job if the world doesn't see fit to compensate it at the same level as my neighbor two doors down who writes software, or the doctor upstairs, or whatever it is?
Right. And if you left this community, though, it would be a different financial expectation. And again, you know, it's funny, we keep coming back to capitalism, which was never really a topic
Sorry.
In my book. No, there's nothing to apologize for, but there's truth in it, because it placed an inordinate amount of definition of success on the amount of money that I made. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I made a good living at the time. I mean, by all standards, I am doing well, except buying a home. And that is what it's no longer about my income. It's really about the cost of living. That's what the conversation is about. And the problem is that it quickly gets placed onto the individual rather than the society.
But the society also plays a role in this, I think. And there's a chapter that for me spoke to this a lot, or a passage, I guess, where people start looking through you and physically right. putting their hands through you as you're trying to explain to them what you do. Someone says, I think you're it's amazing you've made it as an artist, and here you are like struggling to find a new home, and then you're like, but I'm a writer too, and they just don't even hear that.
Exactly. And that's the metaphor scene that I created to say that we cannot communicate with each other from these different camps, mm-hmm. that we literally cannot hear what the other is saying. And yes, exactly. That scene, the there's a mediator, there's three of us. There's a man who seems to be able to hear me and be able to hear his friend. And on one hand, he's saying, yes, it's an incredible feat what you've managed to do. You've managed to make a living and a name for yourself in San Francisco as an artist. That is a, you know, you're in the top percentile of the people who are trying to do this. And then on the other hand, you've got a person who is a longtime San Franciscan who owns many properties and real estate. And she can't understand a word I'm saying. And when I listen to her, it comes out as babble. I can't hear her either. And so again, yeah, I'm not the only sane man, which is, you know, a trope for a type of character who all the things happen to in the world rather than him or that character, right? Being part of the entire system. And so she can't hear me and I can't hear her. And that, I think, is something I was trying to not do in the book. And again, not having judgment, not say, oh, I'm the renter and therefore I'm in the right because I feel I'm being wronged, because I felt that the book would be a very one-dimensional point of view if I did that, because that's not how I feel either.
Yeah, and that was what struck me too, is you're not necessarily taking the moral high ground here.
Exactly.
It's just an experience. But at the risk of being that same person who ignores one aspect of what you do, we should talk about the illustrations as well as the
sure.
text.
Yeah.
Because you are, in fact, an accomplished artist with an upcoming exhibition at the Legion of Honor, if I understand
correctly. Yeah, actually,
correctly.
So that is in June of 2018.
Wow.
At the Legion, yeah.
And you've also called your style of pairing the art and the writing non-linear, in the sense that what we're reading isn't necessarily depicted literally in the art. And instead, you know, we see toys in the street in front of beautiful old Victorians, or just, you know, the corner of a building. Why?
Well, I'll talk about it specifically for this book, which the relationship became closer for this story and these images, because it was one specific idea. You know, I had this goal of, it was about loss. And so there's two themes that happen with the drawings. And the first is abandoned objects. And so most of those drawings are objects that I saw on the street. And the first is a chair with a pair of shoes on it and a blanket and an empty beer bottle. And that was literally across the street from my flat. Hmm. I came out the door across the street and there was that. And I just thought, well, this is a perfect image to sort of dictate what the visual theme is going to be. And then the theme began to change and these burns appear on the drawings. And that's where I switch, and a switch happens in the story as well, because we begin to understand that this is about a greater loss. And that's when I, as the creator, began to understand that this was the end of Oliver Coffee, that I, by writing this series, I wasn't able to go back. I would not be able to look at San Francisco and draw it in the same way, because there was sort of a disillusionment that happened. And so as sort of a personal, I don't even know what to call it. Personally, I wanted to show that to myself. And so I allowed the drawings to disintegrate and I literally drew the burns on them. And so that becomes also a thematic image, that now the images are disappearing. And so to me, that's sort of a note to my audience of, oh, this thing that I've been giving you all this time, I don't think I can give it to you anymore. It's part of my life is ending. And so you're losing this too. And they can visibly watch the images disintegrate as the book goes on.
In fact, at one point we do get a literal crossover between the illustrations and the book, when the burn mark, I think, starts following you around.
Exactly. So I realize that it's not a cloud in the sky, but a burn. And it becomes this very, that's where I amp up the absurdity, and the future me comes and talks to me. And then it becomes this time disappears. We don't really understand. Like, the present is the past, is the future. And that's very intentional because I want us to not know where we are in time. Because, again, it's that sense of when you have loss, all of these, your perceptions start to change. And until that loss is over and you've moved on, you don't have a before and after. You know, when something significant happens and then years later you can look back and it becomes a defining line. Oh, before this, you know, it's a marker in your memory, but at the time of living it, it's not a marker. It's just this ambiguity.
Mm-hmm. Was it a conscious choice to have the burns, the area that has been burned out, be white blank space?
Yes, absolutely. Because in the negative space of my drawings, I leave the paper texture so that you can really feel that this is an object, a drawing object. And so to knock that out was sort of very pleasing to me graphically and aesthetically because it was such a contrast.
Yes. Yeah. And for me also, I have no idea if this makes sense, but at the very end, when everything is sort of disappearing into whiteness, that for me went full circle to when you're jumping out of an airplane and you get engulfed. I mean, I assume that when you jump out of an airplane, you get engulfed by clouds and right, everything right. goes white and disappears and you're sort of in blankness. It's not that you're in darkness where something, you know, could come out and get you anytime. It's just nothingness. Everything is gone.
Yeah, well, I the idea of darkness feels like an end,
mm-hmm.
whereas of lightness is you're being overwhelmed by the new.
Right.
And it's overwhelming the senses, so it sort of blows everything out. It's oversaturated. And I like that because it is ultimately a positive end. You know, the idea of onto the next dream is that we all have dreams, and the best thing that can happen to us in life is to have our dreams come true. But then, you know, what's even better is to be done with it and say, oh, I can dream something else. And I can maybe have a new dream come true and go after that. And that was a realization to me. And it became a very, you know, I talked earlier about, you know, emotions in retrospect, but that became something I held on to as of sort of climbing out of my own emotional hole, which was, I get to have something new. This can be wonderful. My life isn't over.
You know? Is there something that sparked that? I mean, how do the rest of us go on to the next dream?
I mean, ultimately, it comes down to a really simple decision that we have to decide. Do we want to be happy in our lives, or are we going to let events tear us down? I mean, that becomes our choice, I think. I do believe that there are circumstances that are so overwhelming that we are unable to repair ourselves. So it's not to say blanket, everybody should just get over it and be happy, because I don't believe that either. But I think if we have the power to choose, we have to give every ounce of energy to seeing if we have that power. And if we do, then we summon it and we use it and then we can build on it.
Paul, we're out of time. For anyone who hasn't read your book yet, where can they get their hands on it?
City Lights. Bookstores all over the city, but City Lights is the publisher and they're a fantastic store.
Okay, thank you so much for talking with me today. We'll be back 2 weeks from today with news and narratives from the neighborhood. If you'd like to get in touch, shoot us an email at info@missionlocal.com. Up next, it's Back to the Music. Keep it right here on BFF.fm. Thanks for listening.